Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Mark Bayshore, 43 years of volunteer and career experience, former chief of Prince George's County Fire and EMS, where he served as second longest chief in history, former public safety director in Highlands County, Florida, along with former emergency manager in Mineral Springs, West Virginia. Chief Bayshore cut his teeth within PG County at some of the busiest stations where being mediocre wouldn't cut it. From physical fitness, training, education, communication, and community, Mark explains his successful journey within the fire service while also dropping a few gems and nuggets along the way. With that, I present Mr. Mark Bayshore.
Hi, I'm Mark Bayshore. I'm the retired chief from Prince George's County, Maryland, also a public safety director down in Florida and emergency services director in West Virginia. And how I got in the fire service really isn't a mystery to most people from my time frame, and that was the show Emergency is what drew me to the fire service. No one else in my family, I'm not the typical fire service veteran. There is no one else in my family in the fire service. My father was a World War II veteran, and when he came back from the war, he was a mailman and a preacher for 32 years concurrently. So I've got two brothers. One is a preacher in California, actually moving to Virginia, and the other is a retired mailman now in Washington State. So they took his side of the tree, and then there's me. So I credit that upbringing, but really the show Emergency is what drew me in.
Okay. I mean, I can't say, I know about the show Emergency, so it was before my time, but I have heard other people talk about that show, and I'm pretty sure it's the two-man squad, correct?
Yeah,
that would run various sorts of calls. So I'm with you.
That was a time when paramedics in the field were unheard of. And it was kind of a California thing at the time. And everybody thought, oh, that'll never happen. Well, look at us today.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Okay. With that being said, Chief, how did you get your foot in the door? Did you start as a volunteer or did you immediately go career?
Yeah, no, I started at the age of 16. I could be a junior volunteer. I joined at the age of 16. Some places around the country allow you to join even earlier than that. But in Prince George's County, you had to be 16. So I joined my local department. It was about half a mile from my house. I used to literally ride my bicycle to the firehouse because I couldn't drive yet. And from the day I was voted in until... first I went to dispatch as a volunteer dispatcher. Then I took a job as a dispatcher. Then I took the Recruit Academy class and worked my way up. As a job, all I knew was I was going to be in public safety. And I had applied for the fire department, the police department, and the Secret Service all at the same time. Now, for those who don't know, the Secret Service training grounds are there in Prince George's County. So I'd applied for the Prince George County Police, Prince George County Fire Department, and Secret Service. I had been called to take all three tests. I was deep into the police department's process, their blue book process, when the fire department called and offered me a job. And here we are.
That's all she wrote. Okay, so you accepted the call from PG. How was... I'm assuming back then you had to do some sort of rookie school, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even though I had training, I mean, my class was one, class 18 was the number. I think they're on 60-something now. But class 18, we had an A and a B. The A class was inexperienced. The B class was experienced. We all still had to go through the majority of the training. They just did more intensive training with the inexperienced class. They put the inexperienced class through first and sent us out to the field immediately. When they hired us, then they brought us back and got us trained the way they wanted us to be trained, as opposed to the way maybe our volunteer firehouse told us to do things. Does that make sense? It's we still had to go through the training, but it was less aggressive, which I know is a question coming up, and less intense probably than the A class.
Okay. And can I ask which volunteer organization were you a part
Yeah,
of?
so Bowie Volunteer Fire Department, and they're on the kind of the eastern edge of Prince George's County, right up against Anne Arundel County. At the time, completely a bedroom community of Washington, D.C. There wasn't much between, coming out of D.C. in Prince George's County, you've got Sea Pleasant, and then that gets into the Landover area as you're coming towards Bowie. And then there was this big stretch of nothing but trees and turf farms. That was between roughly Sea Pleasant and Bowie. Now it's one big, it's one big urban area, if you will, and there's not much. All of that turf farm and all those woods are all paved over or built on between DC and Bowie now. But yeah, so that's where my parents settled in 1962, and then us boys came along, and here we are.
Okay. Back then when you started with PG, has PG always been the way it is now, meaning fast pace, lots of calls, aggressive mindset? Has that always been the history with PG?
Yeah, so in 1970, yes, I'll give you a little bit of the total history in just a couple of minutes. So in 1972, the county enacted a charter form of government. And in that charter form of government, it said they would have a county fire department. So prior to that county fire department, they were all volunteer. Now, did they, some of them paid a driver, some of them, may have paid a apparatus technician, something to that effect. But they were all independent VFDs, state of Maryland 501c3s, the federal government nonprofits. They owned their equipment, they owned their facilities, they paid their bills, they held barbecues, you name it. That's how they funded themselves. And of course, there was some door-to-door kind of fundraising that you really don't see much of today. And then in 19 it was 70, and by 72 they established the county department and a director of fire, and then from there that evolved into fire chief. That's pretty typical of fire departments even today that combine. They typically want to start out with a director title because they feel that it's going to make it smoother for volunteer chiefs who feel threatened by a county coming in to combine the services. But that's what they did. It was, I'll say it was not always as busy and aggressive as you see today. It became really an aggressive department when the apartment buildings they started building in the 50s and 60s started to burn. Because of course they didn't have any sprinklers back then, and a lot of housing was coming out of World War II. A lot of housing was programmed to be built, and then you had the baby boomers and all that. That all started moving out of Washington, D.C., and people started coming to Washington, D.C. Well, they had to have somewhere to go. Prince George's and Montgomery County, Maryland, are the only two jurisdictions that share a land border with the District of Columbia. Otherwise, it's the river that Virginia shares. So Arlington and Fairfax on the Virginia side. So it's just a natural drive across the street to get into Prince George's County. And a lot of apartments were built, a lot of tract housing, none of it sprinklered, none of it with smoke alarms, and a lot of fire that came out of that environment. Frankly, there were some depressed areas right inside the Beltway that where people didn't take care of their stuff as much as you would say a nicer area, whatever that would be. And that's all on your interpretation. But in 1992, they enacted sprinkler legislation, which drastically began to, well, there was a couple other steps in there, firewalls that were built in because of fire codes and different things. That really began to cut the apartment fires down. It didn't eliminate them. It's still a good amount of fire out of Prince George's County, and it's still an aggressive department. There's some volunteer organizations that are more aggressive than others. Some county firefighters are more aggressive than others. Aggressive is not a bad term.
Right.
The difference, and this is this is very important for me and very important, I think, for a lot of people that don't necessarily understand it. It's not necessary to always be aggressive. You don't always, I'll use an example, a dumpster fire. Do you need to be an aggressive on a dumpster fire? Most likely not. Is it up against a building and you got to make sure you get it before the building? Okay, the circumstances will tell you whether you need to be aggressive. But aggressive is a good term. It's you're either aggressive or you're recklessly incompetent. So you're either aggressively competent or recklessly incompetent. There really isn't any aggressive incompetence. So you know what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You either know what you're doing and know how to do it or you don't. And when you don't and you're still trying to act, you're becoming recklessly incompetent. And that's where training and all the other things, you know, that Prince George's County allowed us that not just because of the activity, but because of the aggressiveness of that county department, kind of bringing all of the entities together, some of them screaming, some of them kicking and screaming, bringing them all together under a centralized training program. And then the state of Maryland with Maryland Fire Rescue Institute really had a great, they have a great complex of regional training academies and kind of set the standard for the counties to follow as far as, you know, implementing standards and implementing training, which keeps us in a healthy state of aggressive readiness.
Okay. With that being said, when you, where were you assigned at upon completion of your rookie school?
Yeah. So my first rookie school station. So when, I'll back up. When I came out of the academy after they hired us and put the second half of the class out in the field right away, they put me back at dispatch because they hadn't hired my replacement. And I was working full-time at dispatch when I got the job as a firefighter. So they put me back there. And then when I came back to the academy, finished my class, they sent me to Clinton Station 25. Station 25, for those who don't know, at the time had a pretty strong volunteer contingent. We had at that time one shift firefighter and three day firefighters. The shift firefighter at three, well, at the day firefighters work 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. And at 3 p.m., we'd all go home. And that shift firefighter stayed there by themselves as far as paid staff and depended on volunteers to help get them out, either the tiller, ladder truck, the engine. We had some water supply unit things there, brush truck, and then the ambulance. Pretty busy. It has the most, it has one of the bigger first due response areas, but it also has the most nursing homes of any station in the county in its first due response area. So from a EMS perspective, it was pretty stinking busy. Did that time there, then went from there to Station 45 Croom. We were implementing shift people back into that station. The night and day difference. Station 45 Croom is a very slow country department. Even today, it's not quite as slow, but it's even today, it's still a lot of country, a lot of non-hydrant areas, and a lot of cornfields and tobacco fields. They used to be a big thing, but not anymore. After that, I went from Station 45 to diametrically opposite side of the county at Station 29, Silver Hill. And that's where I would spend, not only cut my teeth on, I did some of that at Clinton, but I'd cut my teeth on fire and becoming a student of the game at Silver Hill. I spent 5 years at Silver Hill, first as a firefighter, then a technician, as the driver, promoted into that, then the sergeant, when our sergeant went out on a disability. Then we switched the ranks and did away with sergeants, and I became lieutenant. After that, went to Morningside Station 27 as a captain, which is a neighboring station, both very busy places. At the time, both had pretty active volunteer forces, and you know, went about the rest of my time as a captain between there, and then I went to the office and worked with the deputy chief of operations, which allowed me to really get out and respond to a lot of calls and go to a lot of places. So I'll just go ahead and finish out the time in Prince George's. I actually left Prince George's County when I could first retire in 2005, January 2005, and went. I was deputy chief of operations at the time, so I got promoted to battalion chief and then a assistant chief. We called them majors, and then lieutenant colonel, which today it's deputy chief. I went to West Virginia, took a job as emergency services director in Mineral County. That was an all-volunteer, very country place. It was my wife and I were just kind of ready to retire. We built a log home on the side of a mountain, did the whole Daniel Boone thing, and did that for 5 years before I came back to Prince George's County as chief in 2010. And then, I went to work, really went to work, and did that until 2017 when I came to Florida and helped Highlands County, Florida build. They were building or asked me to build a county department out of 10 independent volunteer departments, much like what Prince George's County went through 50 years prior. So something I had a little bit of experience with, and accomplished that, did that for 3 years, and then here we are. I'm currently executive editor with FireRescue1.com and FireChief.com, and out there on the road consulting and teaching and doing all of those things. That's it in a nutshell. Big nutshell.
I'm going to kind of go back a little bit. While you were cutting your teeth at both of those respective busy stations, did you find yourself wanting to find those positive go-getter type firefighters to emulate?
Absolutely. Those were places, Silver Hill specifically, but also Morningside, but Silver Hill specifically was a place where you didn't go if you weren't aggressive. You didn't go to those places to retire. You went to those places because you were hungry, and I had to search out those people because I had been at, for the year prior to that, I had been at Croom, at a very slow, very laid back. Again, it was they were starting shift people, so I was one of those shift people then by myself, after 3 p.m. and on weekends. So I had to search out those people. And fortunately, like I said, you don't last at places like 29 and 27 and 26, which is District Heights, and you don't last at those places if you are not aggressive and you are not indeed a student of the game.
Okay. And at what point did you? I always like to ask every guest when they promote, what caused your internal breaker to trip to go, like, all right, I'm ready for this next step? Or were you, in some cases, some individuals are kind of pushed, like, hey, you need to promote.
Yeah, I don't think that I was ever pushed. I think there were some people who saw in me some ability and tried to get me to, go certain places or do certain things. But it wasn't so much the pushing, and this is a selfish answer to your question, as it was seeing some of the people getting promoted. But this was
Right.
my first response, seeing some of the people getting promoted and making my internal decision that I wasn't going to work for that person.
Right. Understood. And that happens a lot. You hear that a lot. So it's not really a selfish, it's one of those things. Hey, why'd you promote? Because I didn't want to work for this individual.
And that's just sad reality. And I'm sure there's people that would say that about me or any other chief is, you know what, I took that promotion because I wanted to get away from that person. In my case, I saw some people on a pretty quick trajectory up, and I both wanted to be on that train, if you will, but I also didn't want to find myself in a position to have to be working for some of those individuals. And that was enough motivation for me to test well, take the test, be aggressive in my studying, but not aggressive in the test taking because I wanted to make sure I got the test right, because that's what everybody grades you on, right? If you go into a testing situation and try to be aggressive, like you're going down a hallway that's on fire, and pulling babies out of apartments and all of that stuff, and you try to apply that to your test taking, you're going to do yourself a disservice. Test taking is a time to slow down. Now, demonstration in practical testing, that's a little bit different. But test taking, slow down, take your time, and get it right. And I think that's what I did.
Okay. Gonna fast forward a little bit. So you mentioned, you retired, went out to West Virginia with you and your wife, and you were just relaxing. When you received the call, or however that process came about, hey, Mark, we'd like for you to become fire chief, what was your initial reaction there?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I have a great answer for what my initial reaction was, but my initial reaction is you got to be freaking crazy. I not in a million years would I have thought that I would find myself in that position. I wasn't endeavoring to do that. I was not, and I'm somewhat of an albatross in this particular topic I'm going to bring up. I had attended three different universities and colleges, but I did not and have not attained a degree. I was a 30-year at that point, or 35-year street firefighter, and cutting my teeth on those streets, learning not only the job of and the game, if you will, of fire, but learning the politics that goes in to making the decisions we make. That's what made the difference for me, and why they called me was because I understood the politics. I knew a lot of those elected leaders. I didn't donate to any of them, not because I donated to them or because I worked their campaigns. I didn't do that. I didn't knock on doors for them. I understood what made them tick, and I understood what made them sick. And that just comes from putting the time in and observing and watching how these people respond to things. And if you know what makes them sick and you know what makes them tick, then you've got the beginnings of the sauce to be able, that magic sauce, to be able to make something out of those relationships. And that ability was the biggest part of what got me in the door and then kept me going. As far as building relationships, I mean, let's face it, I'm, even though I'm a dark skin with my Florida tan, I'm a white guy that was coming into a department that was in a majority African American community that had all African American elected officials. And there were people who said, you'll never get that job or keep that job. That's okay. That's their opinion. I don't care too much about that. What I cared about was doing the right thing. I think I did that. I became the second longest serving chief of the organization. And in large part, that had to do with understanding politics. And that's not just elected politics, that's dealing with volunteers where I started. That's dealing with unions where I had worked for, at that point, 20 some years with the union, and being able to bring those to the table. Even if they fought like cats and dogs at the table, at least they would come to the table, and I would give them that outlet and that ability to come together. That was a big part of succeeding. So what did I feel like when I got it was, you got to be freaking crazy.
Right. I mean, because that's just, I mean, Prince George's County, for those that don't know, which some might not know, I mean, it's the largest combination volunteer career, department in the nation. Huge area, lots of call volume, lots of action. So if you can, I'd love to hear like certain initiatives and positive things you did while being chief.
Sure. So, a few things that I did were what a lot of people would call window dressing. I call them morale builders. And one of them was we did away right away. We did away with paper general orders and memorandums, and I laughingly called it the Paper Reduction Act of 2011. Up until that point, we continued to send out general orders and memos and all those things. A volunteer department would get, I believe it was five different sets of every order on paper, printed out on paper, and put in the courier system and taken to a fire station. We did away with all that, and we modernized the electronic communications within the department. So everybody ended up getting an email address. Volunteer, career, we gave everybody an email address. We emailed all of the general orders and all the things out. So you immediately had it in your hand or at your ability. We also saved money by not, and it was one thing we never did was quantify how much we saved. So that was the first thing. Then we, and again, these were things that were more about morale and more about opening up communication and kind of giving some of the people the things that they wanted. We did away with the ranks of major and lieutenant colonel. That had originally been done because we had a heavy military presence with Andrews Air Force Base there in Washington, D.C. And the chief at the time wanted to be able to relate to those other services. I wanted to be able to relate to other fire departments. So we changed. Majors became assistant chiefs and lieutenant colonels, which was our second level, became deputy chiefs. And we went away from the chief at the time had birds, had full eagles on the collar. We went away from those to all, you know, bugles, so five bugles. So that box behind me there was my retirement. I'll be the last one. I have both an eagle in there and the five bugles because that's when we made the change. And then we changed the color of the fire trucks. And we went from an all sea grave at the county level to all Pierce. And we changed from white fire trucks to red fire trucks. Why? Because fire trucks should be red. There wasn't any magic to it. There's a million different studies out there that tell you red versus white versus green versus yellow. Not one of those studies can I put my finger on and say they truly made a difference. So for me, it was more about giving the people what they wanted, which was red fire trucks. It's very simple. So we made that change. They continue with that today. They have now, let's see, so 2011, we started with them. So we're on 13-year relationship with Pierce. I know they just took delivery of several tiller trucks, and they got several other things on order. Then we got into some of the more tangible things. And that was first and foremost for me was me as chief getting out of the office and into the field. And anybody that was out there will attest to this. It didn't matter whether it was 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. And I thank my wife and kids for tolerating this. But I would be out at all hours of the day. I would go to their meetings, volunteer meetings. I would go to the union meetings until they asked me to leave just because they didn't feel like they could talk about certain things. I would just show up by myself and sit down at the kitchen table and ask folks what was going on and what could we do to make things better. And at first, there was resistance to that because everybody thought I was there for a negative thing. But that turned into really, I guess you'd say, my trademark of just showing up at a firehouse, opening a door and sitting down at the table. And again, not coming with an entourage of people. I'd go by myself. So establishing that connection and then establishing that same kind of connection in the community, going out to the different homeowners associations and the different the Chamber of Commerce and all those different things. The chief needs to be the one out there starting that relationship building. And then the battalion chiefs and the station officers and all those that came along as time went on. We got pretty heavy into having our fire stations get back out into the community. You know, the volunteers do a pretty good job of knowing who all those local community people are. The paid folks, not so much. They were more about, okay, we're here to do a job and we're going to get the fire trucks and ambulances out. We got them into getting out and visiting and doing the demonstrations and working with the volunteers when they would go to different community meetings and those things. And then I think the other big thing that two big things that I'm proud we started. One was a community paramedicine program, which we called Mobile Integrated Health, because it's really not about paramedicine so much. That was just the industry term at the time. It basically takes, for those that don't know what it is, it basically takes repeat 911 callers and puts them into a queue of this mobile integrated health program that's a combination of the county fire, health department, and then any other agency you need to be part of it, social services or whatever. And it intensifies the amount of services that those people get in a non-emergency setting. So the first person that we put into that program had called 911 90 times in the year prior to us putting her into that program. In the year after we put her in the program, she called one time because our mobile integrated health program would go to her house on a regular basis, make sure she was taking her medications, make sure the slip, trip, and fall hazards around the house were eliminated, or taken care of. And frankly, they just talked to her. Some of these people just need to be talked to. Is that our job? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But it was a program that worked for our communities and something I'm proud of. And then the last thing I'll bring up here is the high school cadet program. We had had one years and years ago. One of our chiefs, Steve Edwards, was one of those high school cadets. But they did away with that program. I don't remember when they did away with it. It was years prior. And one of our challenges of hiring folks was hiring a diverse workforce that looked like the community, okay? No buzzwords there is no, I don't try to put any politics into it. But at the end of the day, you do want people from your community serving in your department. Why would you not? I mean, they're vested in your community, they're vested in those local stations, paid or volunteer. And going into the high schools and establishing a program, which took us 2 years to get into the high schools and get with the school board and get that program up and running and funded, and it took well over 2 years. But we got in and started at Flowers High School, which is over in between Kentland and Largo. And in that first year, we went through a pretty aggressive program of identifying who could be in it by grade point average and interviews with them and their parents. And, it was a program the school board had to sanction. We had, I believe, 35 kids in that first year. Intention was it would be 11th grade and 12th grade, and that's exactly what manifested. So that first year we had 35 kids, then the second year we had another 35 kids. So in those 2 years, we now have 70 kids in the program. The first group graduated after 12th grade, and only one of those came on the and applied to be a paid firefighter. Three or four of them volunteered. Two of them got in trouble at the volunteer house because the discipline wasn't where it needed to be. And they actually skipped school one day and went to the firehouse. Not very smart. So anyways, we by the time the second year came around, nine of those kids applied and got hired into the system. So you can see, and that progression has continued. So you can see how that then begins to infuse kids from the local community into your fire department. Again, paid or volunteer. And I know a lot of great departments across the country have programs like that. We actually went to one down in St. Mary's County, Maryland, that has that program, but it was only there and only a volunteer department at the time. And I still don't think they have more than a couple people they pay to drive today. But they had a great program, and we modeled some of ours after that. We actually expanded what they did. So our kids came away after 2 years. They came away with Firefighter One, Firefighter Two, EMT, all of the requisite pieces along with that rescue tech, hazmat awareness. And then we also worked it out with the state so they would get college credit. So after those 2 years, they had 15 college credits in addition to all the certifications they needed to either be a volunteer or become a paid firefighter. All they had to do was apply and then pass the test. Very successful program. I'm very proud of that. And some of those kids are now working on close to 10 years on the job. And
Right.
that's pretty fulfilling.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You mentioned while you were explaining your accomplishments, communication and how, a fire chief should get out and get in the field. And yes, I'm sure at first, like you, I can 100% relate. When you do something out of the norm, the firehouses are going to think, okay, this person's here for something or whatever, but how important is communication?
Oh, I mean, it's really the bedrock of success. If you can't communicate, with your people, then you're nothing more than a dictator, or not even that. A leader has to be able to communicate, and I don't just mean communicate when things are bad. They need to be able to communicate all the time. That there's also a lesson though to be learned for people in the field, and is that, I used to tell people I have an open door policy, but there's still a door. So just because I come and sit down at your table, there's a certain amount of earned respect for people who are those chiefs, whether it's battalion chief, assistant, a deputy, whatever. And when the chief comes and sits down at your table, there's a certain amount of respect that the crews should exercise. That doesn't mean there's off-limit questions, but that also doesn't mean you start in with MF this and MF that. And, there's a certain amount of respect out of that. Communication is a two-way street. And that is invaluable. It was invaluable for the volunteers. It was invaluable for the union. And again, we used to once a month, when we got everything rolling, once a month, we would come together, meeting over at our fire services building, and it was the heads of the union, the volunteer association, the fire commission, myself, our deputies, and they could bring any of their commissioners or second in commands, if you will. And we sat down and we talked about a myriad of issues. And sometimes there was no agenda. It was just to come and sit down and talk. And we didn't solve all the problems of the world, but we certainly didn't create any by having those meetings. We did create an environment where people felt like, okay, at least there's an avenue for us to sit down once a month and talk to the chief, even if the door is closed today. We know that this month we're going to have the chance to talk to them. So I think that went pretty well. I don't know if they're still doing that today. I know there's, every department has its issues and goes through its cycles. And I know that Prince George's County is going through some of those cycles now. And I talk to Chief Green on a regular basis, and I wish her nothing but the best. And she's definitely dealing with a lot of difficult issues right now.
Which kind of leads to a perfect question. What do, in your opinion, what do you see or feel like the fire service can do better or improve, or if they're doing anything right now regarding recruitment and retention?
So recruitment retention, it is a buzzword that I don't particularly like. It's really about retention. If you retain your people, they will recruit people for you. If your people are unhappy, they're going to project that unhappiness, and no one's going to want to come and work in that environment. So retaining them is really the matter that we should be talking about. How do we get people to stay? And the recruitment will come along with that. And I would rather us focus more on that, how we get people to stay. I think recruitment with the high school cadet programs and those kind of programs is a key tool to get local talent in, but you still have to be ready to exercise bringing in talent from the outside. And that's not again, not a buzzword for anything. I mean, let's face it, when we used to give tests, we'd have 3,000 people show up from as far away as California and Colorado and wherever to take our test because of our history. When New York City does it, 10 to 15,000 people will show up to take their test. So you still have to be in that posture to give those tests and go through those processes. But you need to make your environment less toxic and less authoritarian. And I don't, it should not be a good old boys club, and it should not be a playground. We are a professional force of people who are, that paramilitary rank system. Even though we are not like the military in the sense of being able to have lethal force in our background, we don't do that. But we are from the perspective of discipline and accountability, we should be. And I think if chiefs can improve that morale, that will improve people staying in their organization, which will then help with recruitment because people will see that, hey, they're taking care of their people and those people are happy. I want to go work there. I'd rather see us focus more on retention than on recruitment, because I think recruitment will follow retention. Does that answer what you're looking for?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I like the way you said it, because departments will seem to focus on like, hey, we need to get new people in. And so they are successful at that. And then we see issues where a new person's coming in making more than a person that's been there longer. And it's like, we got to remember, yes, we need people, but the people we have now, we also need to show them love as well. So I totally get your perspective on that. I know you said you wanted to hit on a topic called, you call it, Could You Rescue You? So I'm gonna let you have the floor on that one.
Thanks. So that's the program that I deliver. And every time I deliver it, as far as like at Fire Rescue International or those shows, it's the same basic title and then something else is added to it. So this year at Fire Rescue International, it's Could You Rescue You? And then the subtitle was Establishing Your Personal Mission Statement. So Could You Rescue You is not about Maydays per se. It's not about car wrecks per se. It's not about politics per se. It's about all of that. And the question that I ask people is, if you found yourself in this situation, and I'll show examples, I'll show videos, I'll show headlines, whatever it is, of things that firefighters and paramedics have done and found themselves in the news for, or found themselves in a report for, and we don't necessarily critique that incident, but we talk about, if you found yourself in this position, how would you recover? Or could you recover? Could you rescue yourself from this situation? Whether it's being arrested for DWI, whether it's two fire trucks that wreck in the middle of an urban intersection, whether it's the $32 million lawsuit that a Kansas City couple was awarded because a fire truck hit and killed one of their people. How are you going to rescue you and your organization from these things? So we talk about all of that. And in Fire Rescue International, it was about establishing a personal mission statement. Because at the end of the day, if you don't know where you're going personally, what the hell are you doing? I mean, you need to take care of yourself first before you set about the business of fixing other people. And I think too many times we have chiefs who have come up through the ranks or who have been hired from the outside. They come in and they try to take care of all the problems of the world, yet they're a mess. And we talk about three things holding them up. And I call it the personal success tetrahedron. The tetrahedron is a fourth side. So the fourth side is our mission, our vision, or I'm sorry, our mission, the service. That's the base of it. But the three sides are physical strength, which is both physical fitness and nutrition, then mental toughness and moral focus. Those three pillars hold up the rest of that pyramid, if you will. And we talk about how we bring those things together to bridge the gaps of or lapses within all of those things, and how important it is for you to focus on that as an individual and an organization to be able to uphold the service and uphold the public trust. So that again, I deliver that with different secondary lines. Sometimes it is a review of Maydays. Sometimes it's a review of a particular incident. Sometimes it's just 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever. I'll be in Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey in October, two places in Maryland, then Delaware and New Jersey, and maybe Pennsylvania. We're working on that to be able to deliver that Could You Rescue program anywhere from 2 to 6 hours at those different places. And we'll talk about a myriad of issues that these fire departments deal with. And then we'll talk about some solutions to hopefully help them succeed. And I end every one of the presentations with my personal story of success, and not about Prince George's County, or it's not probably not what most people think. And that's two particular things. One is alcohol. So I don't alcohol and physical fitness, we'll put that together. And then the second was a personal health challenge I had. The alcohol. So there was no, remember I told you in the beginning, my dad was a World War II veteran and a Marine, and then a preacher and a mailman. So there was no alcohol in my house. And here I am joining the fire department because of emergency. It was what drove me to ride my bike over to the firehouse and put in an application. And we all know the fire service culture is heavy on alcohol, right? I mean, it's just some of it is how people cope with things. Some of it is just the way it's been. Firehouses used to have alcohol in them. I guarantee you there's some people listening right now that have alcohol in their firehouse. I know it still exists. It shouldn't. Because what does alcohol do? Alcohol affects your brain and your ability to process. So it's not something we should be mixing the two of them, just like illicit drugs. So back to the alcohol. So there was none in my house, but I'm joining the fire department. And boy, was I tested with people. Oh, come on out. Come on over to such and such. Let's go over to Bowie Inn and sit down and have a beer. And I was always tempted, but thankfully I never took part of it. And part of the reason I never took part was during my high school years, so 9th grade to 12th grade, right? 19 of my classmates were killed in drunk driving accidents. And this is how I end my program. And when I say my classmates, I mean in those 4 years of school, 19 of the 600 and some kids that went, or that were in our graduating class, 19 of them died in drunk driving accidents. It was the period of time where Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD, was evolving and becoming something, because it wasn't just a Prince George's County or a Bowie problem. It was a national problem. Kids were dying at an alarming rate because of drunk driving. And I was in a position as a young volunteer, now certified as an EMT and a firefighter, where I picked many of these people up, my friends, off of the street. And in 19 of the cases, they were dead. One particular friend I remember was a pretty good friend from high school. His name was Tim. He went off the side of the road. Again, drunk driving, went off the side of the road at a bridge, was flipped the car, it rolled, he was ejected, and then he and his head specifically was run over by a passing car. I was the first EMT on the scene at Timmy's accident. And that was enough to convince me that I didn't need to follow Timmy over the edge. It wasn't that I think Timmy got in the car and said, "Hey, I'm going to go drink and drive today." It was just what they did. And they didn't understand the ramifications of what could happen. So I credit that with a lot of my success of not getting any alcohol in the first place. Then the last, very last piece is in. Well, I got to tell another piece of the puzzle first. When I was in West Virginia, one day my wife was looking at the newspaper. And now you said it earlier, I went to West Virginia and relaxed. I didn't so much relax because I did go back to work, but didn't take care of myself as much. So my wife's reading the newspaper, and I said to her, for your younger reader or for younger listeners, the newspaper is a thing that's on paper. We used to get it delivered to our houses every day, as opposed to this computer thing, right? So she's reading the newspaper, and I'm sitting next to her over here, and I said, "Honey, who's that fat ass on the front page of the newspaper?" And she flipped it over, and she said, "That would be you, honey." I didn't recognize myself on the front page of the paper because I had let go of my health. I wasn't exercising. All I was doing was eating, and it showed. I'm 6 foot tall. I had gotten to 247 pounds, and that was without muscle mass per se. And made the decision then that I was going to go about the business of taking care of myself. I went through several iterations, Atkins diet, and some other things where I lost 70 pounds and then I gained it all back. And then I'd lose it again and gain some of it back. And I had to do enough research, and I got myself to the position by the time I got hired where I was down to 175 pounds. So 72 pounds below where I was. I was holding that. I was going to the gym 3, 4 times a week. And I made the commitment to the first class I hired. Which I was able to hire 400 kids over the period of time that I was in, that I was going to take care of myself, and I expected them to take care of themselves, and they weren't going to outdo me. Now, they were going to outdo me, We jogged together. We would do some exercise together, and I knew some of them were going to pass me up and outdo me. That's okay. But I needed them to hear that from me, that I was going to take care of myself. I wasn't going to let them consciously outdo me. And then I've maintained that ever since. Last year, 2023, I was probably in the best physical shape of my life. I had, again, some iterations of learning how to better eat and take care of yourself. And then in February of this year, I had a situation that woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, a pain in my back. I've gone through all of the scans and a life scan and all the other things. I've taken care of myself. I don't smoke and I don't drink, so I'm a pretty boring person. And so I had this pain that woke me up out of a dead sleep. I couldn't breathe very well at all. And I told my wife, something's wrong. We need to go to the ER. So instead of calling 911, right, which is what we tell everybody to do. So I drove, or she drove me to the ER, and the radiologist, after doing an x-ray, the radiologist comes out and says, "Mr. Bashore, we found a mass on your lung." You talk about a ton of bricks hitting you in the face. That was it. And I asked what the next steps were, and he said, "Well, we're going to give you some antibiotics, and we'll get you married up with a pulmonologist next week." And he says, I looked at the report after that, and he said, it says a mass or pneumonia, but leaning towards mass. So the next morning, same thing, couldn't breathe, needed to go to the ER. That doctor doesn't do anything, literally says, "I don't know what you want me to do. They did everything yesterday that I would have done." 2 days later, same thing. We ended up going to a different ER. And that doctor came out and asked me if any of those people told me I had a collapsed lung, which they had not. So for 4 days at that point, I had been living on one lung.
Right.
I'll fast forward this whole thing. I spent 33 days in the hospital from that point. Nothing they did would reinflate my lung. My wife did some research while I was in and found one study out of India with 15,000 lung patients, and only one of them had similar circumstances to what I had. So what ended up happening was a pneumonia in my lung in the center lobe on my right side exploded. That busted holes through that center part of the lung. So that's why they couldn't reinflate it. Six different tubes were in me at some point to try and do the reinflation and glue it to the chest wall and you name it. I lost 35 pounds sitting in the hospital, and the doctors told me then that had I not been as good a shape as I was in, I likely would not have survived. They said most people would not have survived that initial collapse the way it happened, the explosion of the pneumonia and the blowing apart of the center part of the lung. They just said most people wouldn't have survived it. And had I had other medical challenges or physical challenges, that I likely would not have survived. So I credit that physical training that I had gotten myself into for rescuing myself. So back to the could you rescue you, for rescuing myself from an internal problem that I really had no control over. It was just something that happened. I made the conscious decision when I got back home to not let losing 35 pounds and looking like a very, very sick, frankly, very sick cancer patient at that point is what I looked like. I made the determination I wasn't going to allow that to define me. At the end of the day, there was no cancer. There was no mass. It was all the pneumonia. Everything that they tested came back negative. And I made the decision I wasn't going to allow that moment in time to define me. And I went about walking, went about getting back into the gym as soon as I could. And I'm back to being in the best physical shape that I've been in my life. Here we're about 5 months out from that surgery. And I'm not lifting as heavy as I was, but I don't need to. And I encourage people to not be the next one having their pneumonia blow up on them and not surviving because they didn't take care of themselves. And that's pretty much how I end every one of those programs. And I hope that it resounds with people that listen, that you know what, it's a lot of attitude, and it's a lot of what you put into your body and how you take care of yourself. At the end of the day, when God wants me, he's going to take me. But you know, I'm here today, and I'm spreading the message.
No, and that's a message that needs to be heard, because you know it as well as I do. We have individuals in the fire service that think, not me, or we're never going to run this type of incident, or we're never going to have this type of call. And I'm in shape. Like, I'll be ready when that tone, when the bells go off, and it's all a facade. And you know, you're living proof of that. So that's awesome. I do have one question. So do you still currently only have one lung?
No, I the 33 at the 33rd day, they finally decided to take the tubes out and see what would happen. That's exactly how they said it to me. I had in my words, right? I had amazed them while I was there that while I was there with the one lung operating, the other one totally collapsed, that I never needed oxygen. They put me on oxygen in the beginning, but my O2 sats were always high. And they finally just took off the nasal cannula, and most of the time, probably 25 of the 33 days I was there, I wasn't on any oxygen. So I was surviving well on that one lung, and they were able, before I left, to inflate it about 25%, but they could not, they just couldn't get it to go all the way back up. And I went into some physical therapy and occupational therapy and all those things. And ultimately, in my second visit back with the pulmonologist, he said it had gotten itself to about 90%. And that was probably the best I was going to get. So I don't feel a deficit. I'm not able to fly yet on the pulmonologist's order. So that'll come at the end of September. I've got some trips scheduled. And, you know, knock on wood, the danger is that the depressurization that occurs in the airplane could cause the lung to deflate again, but they're comfortable after 6 months that that won't just spontaneously happen. We'll see after that first flight, but hopefully I'll still be okay on one lung until they can get me somewhere. If that does happen, we'll see.
Okay. No, awesome. Awesome. I'm glad to see it. I remember what you would post about it. I'm sure those hospital beds are not comfy.
Oh,
You
no.
can really never get a full night's sleep because somebody's always coming in, having to check vitals. It's so
Check
I can
vitals,
understand.
take blood, do X-rays, three times a night they would wake me up for all of those things. So yeah, not fun.
No, definitely not. I always ask the guests an end goal. So like if I'm talking to a firefighter or whatever the case may be, I'll always like to ask, like, where would you like to retire at? But with you retiring and then coming back as fire chief of the same organization you rose the ranks through, I'm still gonna ask, but what are your plans? What do you have going on?
So, you know, I'm still doing executive editor for firerescue1.com, firechief.com. So I encourage people to visit there. All of the news and information that, you know, you can think of, it's there. There's also Fire Rescue One Academy. So there's a lot of training opportunities there. So I'm doing that, and I continue to speak at conferences, deliver the classes, the Could You Rescue classes. On the back of my challenge coin, and I'm not sure, I think this is it here. On the back of my challenge coin, it really does answer your question. And that is my personal mission statement, which I'm going to try and see if the screen will take it. But so my personal mission statement is on there. We're going to try. And that is inspiring transformation to help others achieve their maximum potential. Okay, so when you ask the question, what am I doing? I hope that's what I'm doing, is inspiring others to achieve their maximum potential. And if that means they're chief of the department somewhere, great. If that means they're a 30-year firefighter somewhere, great. If that means they're a volunteer somewhere, great. Everybody's not destined to be chief. Everybody's not destined to be a paramedic. Everybody's not destined to have a college degree. I'm not trying to make anybody anything other than what their greatest potential will allow them to be. And they're the only ones that hold themselves back from achieving that. I'm just the cheerleader behind them trying to get them there.
Oh, well said. Well said, Chief. Like I told you earlier, I appreciate you accepting the invite to come on. Like I said before, I'm a huge BG buff, so being able to sit here and listen to you talk about the highs, the lows, what you've brought to the table, the things you continue to do for the fire service. And one thing I would like to add, I'm not really sure. I know my my parents used to always say you never ask a woman their age, but I'm not sure how old you are, but you are in phenomenal shape, great shape. I see your posts and I'm like in my head, when I get to the point of retirement, I would love to kind of look like that, to be here as long as I can for my wife, for my daughter. So you, sir, are definitely setting the
Thanks.
example for
I
that.
appreciate it. I appreciate that. And that's what it's all about is, you set the example, and if others follow, that's what I'm trying to do. If they don't, hopefully somebody will embarrass them into following, or maybe your wife will be reading the newspaper one day and you won't recognize yourself on the page. So.
Right. No, and that's all it takes is for you to, because sometimes some people don't realize they have gotten to that point, whether it's physical fitness or
So.
drinking, whatever the case may be, you need that realization.
Yeah, and walking in the store and having to think about buying a 42 pant waist pant. Yeah, that
Now.
wasn't happening.
Chief, Bayshore, I really appreciate it, sir. Thank you for coming on, talking shop.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Take care.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.